Now, since we're in Dallas, we thought it was only appropriate to start the program with two mavericks. One of them danced with the stars, and one of them went to the big dance with President Bush. Kevin Sullivan got his start in communications in the sports world with the Dallas Mavericks. The lessons he learned in the NBA's Western Conference ultimately landed him in the West Wing, where he served as President Bush's communications director from 2006 to 2009. Today, he draws on his experiences to advise leaders all across sectors on effective communication. And last month, he released an e-book called Breaking Through, Communications Lessons from the Locker Room, the Boardroom, and the Oval Office. Our other panelist has no problem breaking through, especially when it comes to making his voice heard by the referees from his courtside seats. Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavericks, is one of America's most successful entrepreneurs, beginning at the age of 12 by selling garbage bags door to door. Along the way, he learned a lot about the kind of perseverance it takes to survive the ups and downs that any leader must navigate. And finally, I think this is an appropriate setting to share that in just 2 weeks, Mark will be adding another job title to his long resume, President of the United States, with his acting role in Sharknado 3. So Mark, if you need some tips, there are a couple of very distinguished gentlemen here who would be willing to share some advice. Please welcome Kevin Sullivan and Mark Cuban.
Thank you, that's awesome. Thank you, Kevin. That's awesome.
Oh, that's funny.
Well, everybody, that was a great introduction from Secretary Shalala. But just to show you how far Mark really has come, take a look at this photo from his early days in Dallas. What was that, about 1982 or 83?
Yeah, 83,
and
yeah.
At that moment, Mark, you know, getting involved with computers, personal computers for the first time, you see the American dream taking hold right there, about ready to...
Do you see the thing in the back that says, poverty sucks?
So you're a guy who's, I've seen you quoted as saying, it's in the doing, not the dreaming.
Exactly.
But what is the state of the American dream today? The
American dream is alive and well. Does anybody here watch Shark Tank?
Yeah.
It's a great show, and the fascinating thing about the show on Friday nights is that it's the number one show watched by families together across all of television. Literally, it used to be people wanted to come up and talk to me about basketball. Now I have 8, 10, 20, 80-year-olds telling me about their ideas and telling me about their companies. You know, it's a new age lemonade stand, and I don't think there's any question that with American ingenuity, the education, the type of people we have here, that this is just the best is yet to come. I think some of us get the sense that, oh, we're down, or that's so far from the truth. I'm just seeing more and more amazing businesses, more and more amazing ideas every single day, and you know, I couldn't be more excited about the American dream.
You have to go to Silicon Valley or New York City?
No, heck no. I mean, yeah, I'll tell you this. Hopefully nobody's, there's no media or anybody from Silicon Valley, I'm sure, here. Silicon Valley is like a lot like Hollywood used to be. You know, they're looking over your shoulder for the next big star, the next big deal in Silicon Valley. You come to Dallas, you come to Austin, and you get people who come to work. The university system here is amazing. Whether it's UTD, UT Austin, the school SMU, there's just so many amazing schools where we hire locally. I mean, it's less expensive, but they're just as smart and they're just as driven, and there's just as many businesses being created here. So while I'm not here to say that it's the next Silicon Valley, I'm here to say that Texas is the most amazing state when it comes to not just development talent, but to creating new companies.
Now, the sports fans among us, and I know there's a bunch here, know that you had kind of a tough night last night.
So this week on Shark Tank.
Without rehashing all the details of the DeAndre Jordan commitment.
Oh, you had to say his name. Okay.
From a leadership standpoint, when you have a setback, when you have a tough day, what do you say to your people? What do you say to the fans?
The conversations we've had today, that it's over. You know, there's nothing you can do about it. You think for a second, is there anything I can change? You think for another second, what have I learned so I can do it differently next time? And then you move forward and say, what are our options? You know, I'm a big believer you have to re-earn your business every single day. You have to look to see whether or not you need to reinvent your business every day. Because there's someone out, always someone, there's some 12-year-old, 8-year-old going to UT, SMU, all these great things I just talked about, this great talent, and they're out there trying to kick your butt. Right, and if I'm going to stay ahead, whether it's the NBA or any of my companies, I have to keep on moving forward. And that's the way it is with the Mavericks. You know, we have this big, tall German who's pretty good, and he's still around, and we signed Wes Matthews. So I think, you know, we've been fortunate to this point in my 15 years there, and I think we've got great leadership, a great team, and we're going to keep on moving forward.
Presidents make a lot of decisions, obviously, a lot of tough decisions. And, our scholars have had the privilege of, you know, going to the Clinton Library, for example, and studying tough decisions President Clinton made. I know they studied the landmark welfare reform legislation that he led. You know, and there were people among your own advisors, President Clinton, that didn't think maybe you should go the way you were going or your party. President Bush, same way, a lot of tough decisions I had the privilege of witnessing up close and personal, often with utter disregard for his personal popularity. He did what was based on his principles that he brought from here in Texas to D.C. How do you handle those really, really tough decisions, especially if you're getting conflicting kinds of advice?
I try to be very self-aware. I try to know what I'm good at and what I'm bad at. I try to have smart people around me all the time. And I cross my fingers, you know. There's just some decisions that, you know, you just have to trust yourself. Let me also add, preparation is everything. You know, people have always said, oh, you're such a huge risk taker. I never take risks. You know, any business I've ever started, I've always felt like I've done my homework, I've done the preparation. This isn't a risk. And so, you know, fortunately, I've never been in the same circumstances as our two presidents, and I couldn't even imagine the stress. But in my little world, I just try to be prepared, have great people around me, and be prepared, make the best decision I can, and hope for the best.
And in that preparation as a way to manage the risk, what kind of things do you do to be prepared?
I read everything I can get my hands on. I talk to as many smart people as I can. I like to, you know, someone once said, you have to test your whole card. You know, a lot of times we think we know something, and sometimes success can be your worst enemy because you think you're smarter than you are. And so, you know, even though I feel confident about something, I feel good about something, I'm always like, okay, am I sure that's an ace, or does that change to a jack? So I want to talk to smart people always and check my whole card.
In terms of your team of advisors, I know you're not a big hierarchy guy.
Right,
you like a flat structure. Would that be a recommendation to make to our scholars as they go forth?
Well, everybody's different, but, you know, in today's day and age, there's so many communication mediums, you know, that you've got to figure out, A, as the leader, what your vision is, B, how you can take those people around you and put them in a position to succeed, and C, really understand how each of them needs to be communicated with, because it's not all one size fits all. We're so used to seeing everybody, you know, not just millennials, but everybody with their head down in their phones. And I tend to try to do everything via email as much as I can. You know, send me a weekly update, bad news first. But when I get that bad news, that's when I have to reach out and go face to face, you know, and be there to help people. But you've always got to be in a position where it's not about you, it's about putting people in a position to achieve your goals. Because if you help them and have a vision for them of how to be successful, then that's going to dovetail with the organization. And when that point comes, if it doesn't, where you go your separate ways, there's mutual respect, and that ends up being a contact or somebody for you to network with.
As Secretary Evans pointed out, our scholars are from a really diverse set of backgrounds.
And congratulations to all the graduates.
Private sector, NGOs, government, military, nonprofit, you name it. But the one thing they have in common is that they're going to have to pitch and they're going to have to present their ideas. We've got a clip from Shark Tank to play. This is what Mark says is his favorite pitch that he ever got on Shark Tank. So let's play it. So what about Laney's pitch What about Lainey's pitch was spot on that made you want to...
Everything. I mean, she's a high school student that dropped out of high school to work on her business. She didn't think she had to go outside and raise capital. She didn't say, well, let me ask somebody. She didn't say, well, you know, I was dependent on so-and-so. She just took everything she had to accomplish head on. And she was amazing. I mean, and so we're still partners now. And as a little aside, after this aired, about 6 months later after we did the deal, she gives me a call, you know. And we corresponded, so I knew business was good. She goes, Mark, I have a problem. Mind you, this is, I think, she's 19 at the time. I have $1 million in the bank. I don't know what to do. I said, you celebrate first, you know. That's a high school student. If a high school student can be prepared to walk onto the carpet of Shark Tank in front of more than 10 million people and guys like us, particularly Kevin, Mr. Wonderful, how can you not be able to be prepared and walk into any situation? Seriously. I mean, she was prepared, and she knew her stuff so cold, she didn't flinch. That's why she wasn't nervous. You know, you're not going to get nervous if I ask you your name and address and phone number, because you just know. If you know your project, if you know your business that well, you're not going to be nervous. And you're going to be able to just be yourself when you make your presentation. You're going to be able to show your leadership qualities. You're going to be able to show your vision, just like Lainey did.
Yeah, and I would encourage you, if you're interested, to watch the whole clip, because she got a lot of questions, and she never wilted under the pressure. We have a question from one of our scholars, Terry Hasdorf. She's the VP of Convoy of Hope, which is all about empowering women. She's got a great project to empower women with basic business skills. But Terry asks for your advice on better partnering with the private sector as somebody who is in that nonprofit world.
I mean, it's a numbers game. You know, there's no business, small or large, that hasn't heard from a social enterprise or doesn't have its own social conscience. And so you're not going to be in a situation where you're the only person knocking on that door or picking up the phone and talking to them or sending them an email. And so you have to recognize that it truly is a numbers game, and every no gets you closer to a yes. But there will come a time when that, just when you think, oh my goodness, they're going to say no, bam, that's when they say yes. And so whether it's women's issues, no matter what it is, look, if it were easy, it'd already be done. It's not supposed to be easy. It's supposed to be hard. There isn't a template that everybody follows for success. You have to put in the energy to be prepared. And if you really care about what you're trying to accomplish, it's not work. You know, I always have a test. If you dream about it, it's right for you. You know, if you wake up and you're taking notes about your business because that's what you were thinking about, it's right for you. And if you have that much commitment and conviction, who cares if it's one more door you have to call on? Who cares if there's one more company you have to speak to? That's what it takes.
So as an entrepreneur and an investor, what are the biggest impediments today and obstacles that you could run into for either starting or growing a business?
Yourself. You know, companies don't fail for lack of money 99% of the time. They fail for lack of brains and effort. You know what the one thing in business that you can control? And I say this to athletes as well. The one thing in business that you can control, your effort. That's the one thing no one can ever take away from you and that you can control. And so that is always, you know, that's the key. And if you learn and you're always learning, you're always looking to improve and you're always looking to re-earn your business and you're putting in the effort, you got a shot and you can be successful.
Now, you had another kind of famous Mark Cuban Shark Tank contestant, Scotty Vest was the name of the company.
Right.
And he had a patent. He was basically just trying to license a patent. But why don't you tell that story? Because that pushed your buttons pretty good. It's another one to check out.
Yeah. So there's a gentleman who came on the show, and he had a coat, an outdoors coat. And his secret sauce was he had a lot of pockets. But in his pockets, he had a patent so that if you ran a wire up your sleeve using headphones and connected them to something to listen, that's what he had patented. And I was like, how do you patent that? And no lie, when I was a kid growing up in Pittsburgh, I would listen to the Pittsburgh Pirates, and I'd have a transistor radio that I'd put, like, hide from my teacher, and I'd listen to the Pirates when they were in the playoffs, and I'd run one, you know, those old school headphone things that you could listen that had a wire, and I'd run it up my shirt, and, you know, and I'd put it in my ear and kind of lean this way so the teacher wouldn't see me. And I'm like, how the heck do you patent that? And so I went off on him, and it created this big uproar and led to me funding a chair called at the Electronic Freedom Foundation, the EFF, called the Mark Cuban Chair to Eliminate Stupid Patents. And so I gave him money, and they're like, we can't name it that. People are going to think it's crazy. I'm like, that's exactly the point, right? Because there's so many patents, and to me, that's an inhibitor to progress. You know, I'm a clean room fan. If you go back to the 80s of computers, when there was Compaq and IBM, and if you did it in the clean room and independently created it, then you could run with it and create your company. And that led a big way to the start of the internet and the computer boom. But now it's a race to the patent office to try to get... I literally... Tell another quick story. Back in 2006, I have a movie distribution company called Magnolia and a theater company called Landmark. It's the Magnolia here in town, the Inwood. And so we decided we needed to change things up. So we wanted to put movies on TV, on DVD, and online before they're in theaters. Just natural course of business. We got sued because somebody patented that after reading and what I had done. They created a patent and literally referenced what I was doing in the patent and then turned around and sued me for it. So I gave a little bit more money to that foundation. And but I think there's things that we need to do because it does inhibit progress.
Another scholar question. Shelly Cryan asks, and she's another slacker like most of the scholars, project manager at Charity Logic Corporation, software for nonprofits. Uh-huh. But she's also, her project is teaching teenage girls in the Gambia how to start photography businesses so they can earn money to stay in school. So
oh, wow.
Pretty amazing.
That's very cool.
She asks, on Shark Tank, you measure ROI, uh-huh. You know, when making a decision. But how do you measure the social good or the way it's, an idea would help a community when deciding on an idea?
With ROH, return on your heart. You know, what else is there? You know, it's not easy to get people to believe, you know, but you're not there to, there's no I, that's really, it's about heart. And so thank you. You know, it's something special and, you know, I don't know what else I can say about it.
You know, there's an element of storytelling. We saw that Lainey made her product personal, how it could specifically help you.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the ROH is making it personal. Another question from a scholar, Yasmin Bhatia, CEO of Uplift Education, a charter school network here in Dallas-Fort Worth, whose project is developing fellowships for North Texas urban principals.
Cool.
Very cool. She asks, how do you find the time, as busy you are, just the mental space to think? You're a big idea guy. How do you think?
Because there's not a lot of mental space there, so it rolls over very quickly. I don't know. I just try to, I find things, you know, everything is a progression. You know, I forget the exact Steve Jobs quote, right, where, you know, everything is a remix. That's what it was, right?
Right?
And so the more you consume, the more you learn, the more you're open to learning, the more ideas you have. And to me, I'll put it a different way. The most competitive, and I've said this to Dirk and other Mavs players, the most competitive sport there is business. And I'll add nonprofits as well. And it's comparable. It's incredibly competitive because you're competing 24/7, by 365, by forever. And there's always someone trying to kick your butt. And I am so competitive. I love the competition of it. You know, my basketball game isn't so good anymore. Unless you ask me, then I'll tell you otherwise. But yeah, just the business is a sport. Running a nonprofit in a lot of respects is a sport, and it's nonstop. And so that's what gets me excited. That's what keeps me going. That's why I love to continue to learn.
I heard you say in a radio interview that long ago that your biggest fear was that your kids would grow up to be jerks.
Yeah, my wife is right here, and that's like...
So there's no chance that that's going to happen with Tiffany
yeah,
at the helm.
Yeah, but there's this other guy at the house, you know.
And what did you mean by that? And talk about how you manage
I mean, we try to be as normal as possible. You know, yes, we have help, but we don't have butlers. We drive our kids to school. You know, we put our kids to bed. We're, you know, except when there's a Mavs game, we try to, you know, there we have help during the day, but at night we try to be by ourselves as much as possible. And we try to just make our kids appreciate. It's hard to explain, but I want them to have a little bit of struggle, but not too much. But I want them to learn. I want them to appreciate. I don't want them to feel entitled. And so, you know, Tiff and I try to do as best we can to always make them feel appreciative of everything around them. And some of you got to meet Jakey, and, you know, hopefully he came across as somebody who is going to grow up to be that way. So, yeah.
You read 3 hours a day. Is this every day, give or take?
Yeah, you can ask Tiff. Get off of there. What are you doing? Stop.
You read, you know, on your tablet, on...
Everything from my phone, tablet, newspapers. So I get the Financial Times, New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Dallas Morning News delivered. I could read them online, but A, I feel sorry for newspapers, and B... and B, you just want something different. You don't want to always be staring at a screen. But yeah, and I don't get to read books as much as I'd like to, so it's more content-driven online relative to all the different topics I'm interested in.
Well, Will Simpson, who's with the Mississippi Department of Human Services, and his project is teaching critical life skills to aging out foster kids. So another great, very impressive, ambitious projects. He says, what should the scholars be reading?
Oh my goodness! I mean, that's not a fair question. Read what you love. I mean, read what gets you excited. You know, there are no business books that's it. That's all you need to know. There's no one class. There's no one thing that you can do that's just a shortcut. You know, I was talking to him earlier. I mean, experience is literally the best teacher. But as you dip your toes or as you move forward with your endeavors and your challenges, you recognize the things that are going to be a little bit more difficult. And when I run into those difficulty factors, that's when the antennas go up. Excuse me. And that's where I go out and say, okay, what can I read? Some people are more about what will my mentor tell me. I'm more, okay, I need to be able to consume it. I need to be able to, you know, really internalize it and move forward. And so in terms of what to read, whenever you run into a roadblock or whatever you see related to your vision, you know, I love to read biographies, people who have done things before, like our president's here. There's just so much that you can learn. I'll put it another way. I still walk through, even though there's not a lot of magazines left, I'll walk through bookstores, look for a magazine, because if I find one idea, one thought, it's worth the $5 or $10. Mm-hmm. If I find one book with one idea, it's worth the $20. And so you never know when that next idea that just the light bulb goes on. And so you've got to keep that mind open and look to find it.
Now, one idea that you've had in the last year or so, a couple of years, is Cyberdust.
Uh-huh.
Now, for those of you who don't know, and I recommend it, it's an app, and you can text, and your text disappears on a 24-second shot clock. Now, I know we all know some people, especially in Washington, who could have benefited from
that.
Disappearing social media content. But talk about the way, you know, we live our lives so publicly now.
Right.
As
well, 2 points there. One, with social media now, when we get on social media, we think, okay, our friends, our family, but then it kind of has spread, right? It gets bigger, and our networks extend, and you get to a point then, all of a sudden, where your network, your social media network, says more about you than you realize, and it may say things about you that you don't realize. You know, if you go back and look at your Facebook's friends of friends, in this day and age, unfortunately, people will hold you accountable for that. And so I always make sure I go back and there's an app called Expire, X-P-I-R-E, that allows me to go back and delete all my tweets. Because there's no good reason. It's like fashion, right? People don't need to see that, what you wrote 2 years ago. There's just no point. And then on the app Cyberdust, you know, when you think about messaging in this day and age, the minute you hit send on a text, on an email, iMessage, whatever it may be, the minute you hit send, you don't own it anymore. And if you're a visible person, someone who has a lot of responsibility, there's a good chance that the person you're sending it to is keeping it. Now think about the consequences. You don't own it, they own it, but you still have responsibility for it. It's scary, you know? And over the course of time, like fashion, we all have thousands of texts that we've sent that might have seemed like the coolest, yeah, no problem at all. It's all like the old Seinfeld episode where they're, oh, schmoopy, you know? Just old acquaintances, old business things. I mean, while Sony owns the show Shark Tank, and so while the Sony hack was going on, I made sure my negotiations for my contract were done on Cyberdust, not knowing that this hack was going on. Everything else came out. People lost their jobs. Every single employee of Sony was frantic and scared to wits, but we were safe. And so it's an app called Cyberdust, Cyberdust. It's in the App Store, and if you want to reach me, my username is M. Cuban.
There you go.
But I'm not pitching anything.
Always selling. Well, that's
always fine. Selling,
always
right?
Always selling, right?
Always be selling.
Now, we've got a room full of media here.
Uh-oh.
As well. Now, and you're, so you talked about social media. You like to conduct interviews when you can via email.
Yes, sir.
So why is that?
You know, there's reporters and there's opinion, right? Opinion, yeah, they are who they are. But in reporting, I learned early on that what you say in an email may not be, the full transcript may not be used, and you know that's their job to try to create a story. And so having a full email transcript of any email interview I've done has given me the chance to post on my blog the real story. Now I try to do more of this via Cyberdust, so it's like, Cyberdust is like a face-to-face conversation, so it's a digital version of that. But historically, if it's going to be a longer interview, I'll use email, knowing that on my blog I have a way to post it to protect myself, because you just don't know, you know, how media is going to take anything that you tell them.
So it's your way of controlling them.
Yeah, and particularly in social endeavors, right, all it takes is one misstep or one misstatement of an interview, and you're toast. You know, and if all you did was sit down and, yeah, they have a tape of it, well, this is what I thought you meant. And it's not that email can't have nuance, but at least you have the ability to have all that context.
What advice do you have for our scholars when they are asked by younger people in their organizations to mentor them? What's the best thing you can tell a young person?
Be honest about your time. You know, it just sounds so good to be a mentor and have a mentor. You know, I was never a big mentor person. I was more like, you get my hands dirty. But, you know, it's hard to mentor 20 people or 30 people. Be honest. And as a young person looking for a mentor, realize they don't live their lives to mentor you. that it's a resource that is very, very valuable. And make sure that it's a resource of last resort. And then, look, there's also friendships and there's relationships that go with it that are amazing. But I think you have to really, really understand as a mentor what the expectations are of who you're trying, the mentee, and vice versa.
Secretary Spellings and I attended an event at Microsoft years ago when I'm still working for. If you've ever worked for once, you work for permanently. But Bill Gates was asked a question about his schedule. How do you control your schedule? And he said he had Steve Ballmer check it and cross-check it and not commit to things so far up as if you're not going to be busy then. What advice do you have about the way you commit your time and build your schedule?
I have somebody who runs my life, who does my schedule, but I'm the same way. I don't commit so far in advance simply because I still think the best is yet to come. You know, I'm still excited about all the opportunities that are in front of me, and so I don't want to preclude myself from something. And like a lot of people here, you know, we get asked to speak every minute of every day. I just, you know, like I said, I'm such a strong believer in the American dream. I'm such a strong believer that today is the youngest you'll ever be. You have to live like it. And I'm such a strong believer that the best is yet to come for me. And if that's the case, and my children, if that's the case, then I'm not going to lock anything in. You know, my schedule's TBD, and hopefully will be for a long time.
We have 30 seconds. If you thought the last question was tough, many of our scholars asked, what is the next big thing?
The next big thing is a big center for the Mavs. No, I would say personalized medicine. Our bodies basically are equations, and as computers get faster and faster and faster, we begin to understand more about them. We understand more variables. Let's put this, my son Jake, who's 5, maybe not when he's 25, maybe it'll be when he has kids, but the concept of walking into a drugstore and buying over-the-counter medicine that has a warning that says you might be the one unlucky schmuck that dies from this will seem barbaric. Everything that we take for our grandkids, their kids, will be personalized. You'll take, there's a company, Theranos, you take one little tweak of blood, and they'll do a complete analysis in seconds. And so as we learn more and more about this wondrous body that we have and all the nuance, all the variables that are in it, the proteins, everything, we'll be able to more certainly determine what it takes to cure us. Now, that's going to create a whole new set of questions, you know, that are bigger than me. But, yeah, personalized medicine is definitely something that's going to change the world. And all these discussions we have about the cost of medicine, and everybody trying to predict 10 years out, they're wrong. So, and there's going to be people like you out there that are going to invent even better ways. So there's exciting things to come.
Well, thank you again to the Moody Foundation, and thanks to Mark Cuban. Thank you.